This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with an expert about the role that federal judges play in police violence across the country.
Michael Avery literally wrote the book on this question.
We'll talk about a policing practice called broken windows, used widely in New York City.
Well, it started here, but it's spread around the country and around the planet to deadly effect.
We'll talk with a member of an international tribunal that has recently declared the impeachment of Brazil's president and head of their Workers' Party an illegitimate coup.
Attorney Azadeh Shashashani just got back from Rio de Janeiro, where she was part of a delegation investigating the coup about to overthrow the legitimately elected government of Brazil.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Michael, we recently spoke with Donna Murch about the Movement for Black Lives platform. And in that platform was a statement in solidarity with Palestine, calling acts by Israel essentially a form of genocide. And I understand that the Center for Constitutional Rights then issued its own statement on the matter.
Yes, in solidarity with the platform of Movement for Black Lives in support of the Palestinians, because there was a huge storm in this country that was raised after the black movement issued that position. And the Center for Constitutional Rights, which was founded in support of the black movement 50 years ago, issued a statement. We'll link to it, but I wanted to read part of it, and particularly the quote from Michael Ratner. The statement they issued says, "While there has been recent criticism of those taking the position that Israel is committing genocide against Palestinians, there is a long history of human rights scholarship and legal analysis that supports the assertion. Prominent scholars of the international law, crime of genocide, and human rights authorities take the position that Israel's policies towards Palestinian people could constitute a form of genocide. Those policies range from the 1948 mass killing and displacement of Palestinians to a half a century of military occupation and, correspondingly, the discriminatory legal regime governing Palestinians. Repeated military assaults in Gaza, and official Israeli statements expressing favoring the elimination of Palestinians." Our friend and co-host, the late Michael Ratner, went over there a couple years ago, and when he came back, he spoke widely. And we have a quote in this statement from one of the things that Michael said. Now, remember, Michael was the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights and a human rights scholar and an international lawyer. Ratner also charged Israel with committing incremental genocide against the Palestinian people. And Michael said, quote, "There's no doubt, again here, this is incremental genocide, as Alain Pape, the Israeli historian, has said. It's been going on for a long time, the killings, the incredibly awful conditions of life, the expulsions that have gone on from Lida in 1947 and 48, when 700 or more villages in Palestine were destroyed, and the expulsions that continue from that time until today. It's correct and important to label it for what it is." He argued further that, quote, "I want to emphasize today that these killings are part of a broader set of inhuman acts by Israel, constituting international crimes carried out by Israel over many years, going back to at least 1947 and 1948. They include crimes that aren't talked about much in the media or the press, the crimes of genocide, crimes against humanity, and apartheid. These crimes can be prosecuted in the International Criminal Court and are defined there." So thank you, Michael, for continuing to influence the discussion.
Thank you. In examining the root causes of police violence across the nation, few people consider the role that federal judges play in contributing to this epidemic. According to one of the authors of Police Misconduct, Law and Litigation, a principal cause of police brutality is a widespread unwillingness of federal judges to hold officers accountable for instances of misconduct. The problem even extends to the U.S. Supreme Court, where Justice Kagan has shown deference to two reckless officers who shot and nearly killed a mentally ill woman in her own apartment, rather than waiting for police backup. Joining us to talk about this failure by judges to hold law enforcement accountable is Professor Michael Avery. Former president of the National Lawyers Guild and co-author of the Police Misconduct Treaties for Attorneys on Civil Rights Cases, Michael has reviewed thousands of such cases over several decades. His op-ed in the Baltimore Sun, "Federal Judges Often Let Bad Cops Slide," asserts that judges' failure to hold officers accountable for abuse of authority is a central cause of police brutality in this country. Michael, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure.
In your op-ed in the Baltimore Sun, you write about the case of LaTonya Davis, a disabled African-American woman who was stopped by police and thrown to the ground. Tell us about her offense and what happened in her case.
Well, she was in her car and was pulled over for a motor vehicle violation. And according to her, the police then surrounded her car and began pounding on it with their nightsticks. Two officers came to her window on the driver's side and ordered her to get out of the car. She was terrified. She has had many physical problems and was scheduled for neck surgery at the time. So she was terrified to get out, but she says that she said to the officers, "I'll get out of the car if you won't hurt me." And instead of responding to that, one of the officers broke her driver's side window with his baton, sending shards of glass into the car, one of which evidently got in her eye. And then they dragged her, as she describes it, dragged her out of the car through the window with her hair in her hands, and then threw her down on the pavement, took her into custody. She went to the hospital. In addition to having some injury to her eye, she also had an injury to her shoulder. And then when she filed suit, the district judge ultimately dismissed the case, giving the officers qualified immunity. Even on her version of the facts, the officers dispute some of the facts as she describes them, but it was a preliminary motion in the case, and the judge was obliged to take her version of the facts as true. And even doing that, the judge dismissed the case, claiming that the officers wouldn't have known that it would violate her rights to pull her bodily out of the car through the broken window.
Now, Michael, in your opinion, why do judges afford such deference to officers? Because you write that this happens across the country in different jurisdictions, especially in cases of extreme abuse of authority.
It happens a lot, particularly at the district court level. In Ms. Davis's case, the Court of Appeals reversed the district judge and sent the case back for a trial. But as I read cases from all over the country, I am constantly shocked at decisions that are made by district judges, most of whom who are making these bad decisions having been appointed by Republican presidents. And I think there are two reasons for it. One is that many of these judges are very conservative. They were appointed by so-called law and order presidents, and they have a so-called law and order mentality. And the second is that the current state of constitutional law gives them an opportunity to do that because of this doctrine called qualified immunity. And I can explain that for you if you'd like.
Yes.
Qualified immunity is a doctrine that says even if a public official violates somebody's constitutional rights, that public official cannot be held liable in a lawsuit for damages unless every reasonable official in his position would have known that the specific misconduct in question violated the Constitution. And in practice, what that means is that when there's a lawsuit pending in front of a federal judge, the judge will look in the case law to see if there's a previous case so strikingly similar to the case before him or her that the conduct was virtually the same. And unless you find a case that's very close on the facts, these conservative judges are going to say, well, there's nothing in the case law that would have given an officer notice that his conduct would violate the Constitution.
Michael, are you saying that the fact pattern has to be strikingly similar so that in this case, for example, the officers would have had to pull the driver or passenger out of the window, throw them to the ground?
That's what these very conservative judges insist on, a fact pattern that is strikingly similar. Now, the Supreme Court has said in some cases, well, you don't always need a case that's the same on the facts. If another case would have established a constitutional principle clearly enough that it gave the officer notice, that's enough. But the problem is that even in the Supreme Court, they say that the constitutional principle in question has to be a very narrow one. So, for example, it's the principle that you can't use excessive force, of course, is well established, but that's a very broad principle. So that's why they look for something very, very close on the facts. So you can't use excessive force in these circumstances or with this implement or against this type of person in this situation. And, of course, life being what it is, we're very seldom confronted with cases that are exactly like previous cases.
Now, Michael, isn't it also true, however, that vehicle stops are deemed especially dangerous to law enforcement officers? For that reason, judges may also err on their behalf?
Yes, there was a case several years ago in the Supreme Court called Scott against Harris. And in that case, which happened to involve a videotape, the Supreme Court ruled against the person who was suing the police. That case has been followed by other cases which have broadened the definition of what sorts of danger the police can be concerned about in these situations. So that officers now argue whenever there's a vehicle stop, first of all, you know, some weapon might be hidden in the vehicle. And secondly, if the vehicle moves at all, the officers will claim, oh, the person's trying to run over us. Or even if they're not running over the officers at the scene, they may pose a danger to someone down the road. And so this notion of how dangerous people are in cars has gotten such currency that officers are, you know, given a green light for behavior in these situations that they wouldn't have in other situations.
And even more broadly, isn't it true that officers merely need to claim that they felt they were in danger and the courts won't look beyond that claim and find against the injured person?
Well, here's how the thing works. Officers, of course, generally speaking, are very concerned about danger, and of course they're entitled to be concerned about danger. It's a dangerous job. But what we've seen in the cases over the past couple of generations is, whereas maybe 30 years ago a police officer actually had to see a gun in someone's hands in order to shoot them, then the next generation of cases was, well, I saw something that looked like a gun. Maybe it was a flask. Maybe it was a cell phone. And in many cases, it would be legitimate, in my opinion, for officers to fire under those circumstances. But now we've reached the point where officers can argue, I thought he might have had a gun. In other words, the officer doesn't have to say, I saw a gun, or I saw a shiny object, or I saw something that looked like a gun. I thought he might have had a gun. He was reaching, you know, below the level of my sight in his car, and I thought there might be a gun, and that's why I shot him. And many of these conservative judges are sanctioning that kind of behavior.
And the standard, isn't it, of a reasonable officer in that position?
Well, it's supposed to be the standard of a reasonable officer. But instead of trying to figure out what a reasonable officer would do, the question that the courts are now asking themselves is there any imaginary officer on the edge of reasonableness out there someplace
right.
who might have made a mistake in this situation? And if there was, then we're going to give this officer a pass.
Michael, do you think the Black Lives Matter movement is making any inroads in how these judges consider such cases, or the contrary?
Or the cops that perpetrate them.
Here's how I feel about the Black Lives Matter movement. I've been doing police misconduct cases since 1970, since I became a lawyer, 46 years. And over that period of time, we've seen occasions when the public gets concerned about police brutality. There might be a commission in New York. There have been several commissions over the years, for example. Or people might get together and demand some sort of civilian review. But usually the concern about the issue and the excitement about the issue dies down after just a few months. What we have now with the Black Lives Matter movement and with other people who are concerned about police misconduct is we have had for the past few years some sustained concern about this, maybe going back to the Trayvon Martin incident, maybe going back even further. There's been a steady concern about this. And what I believe is that gives us an opportunity that we haven't had in the last 50 years to do something serious about the reform of police departments. And I think the Black Lives Matter movement is making strides in that direction. And I think the fact that so many people, whether black or white, are concerned about this is a real opportunity now for change.
What would your advice be in terms of serious reforms?
You know, over the years, what I've noticed makes the most difference in any given police department is who the chief of police is or the commissioner of police. If the chief of police or the commissioner of police takes police accountability seriously, then the chief will institute reforms, and the type of reforms we need are well known at this point. We need an early warning system to spot officers who are inclined to use excessive force. We need computer systems that will help us track whether officers are targeting people of a particular racial or ethnic groups or people on the basis of their sexual preference or otherwise for stops. There's a whole book of reforms that are significant if we look at some of the cases that the Department of Justice has done leading to consent decrees. We can see the implementation of those kinds of things in some of the departments around the country. But unless the chief takes it seriously and unless the chief insists on monitoring and accountability and appropriate supervision, nothing happens.
You know, Michael, I was just watching some videos on TV of the Watts Rebellion in 1965 in L.A., where citizens brought attention to racism in the police department. And it just seems that we go through the same cycles decade after decade. Do you think there's hope for systemic change, really?
I think, yes, I do. But, you know, I'm a progressive person who is a civil rights lawyer for my whole career. And if I didn't think there was hope, I suppose I would have given it up a long time ago. But I think there's always hope. There's something interesting going on in New Orleans right now where officers are being trained to be sensitive to misconduct by other officers and to do something about it, to speak to the officer, to report it, to insist that it stop. That's a very exciting development that has some promise. Our friend Mary Howell, who's a civil rights lawyer in New Orleans, is very close to this process and has been monitoring it and feels that it has a real chance to make a difference in the way officers behave on the street. Because for so long, what we've had is the blue wall of silence and officers covering up for each other. So if we could actually get officers in the situation where there was some peer pressure to improve, it could make a very big difference in policing.
Michael, we just have a few minutes left. I wanted to ask, are there any federal judges who have been bold enough to stand up to so-called bad cops?
Oh, yes. Particularly many of the judges that President Obama appointed have been making good decisions in the police misconduct area. And perhaps the most noteworthy is Justice Sotomayor, who in a dissent in a case in the Supreme Court basically called out her fellow judges on the issue of their approach toward police misconduct cases and their willingness to let civil rights violators get away with it. So there are judges who speak out, and there are judges who make good decisions in these cases. The problem is there are too many judges still making bad decisions.
And finally, if you were special advisor to the next president, what words of advice would you have for that person?
If the president hired me as a special advisor, I would say, listen, too long you've been putting former prosecutors on the bench. Let's put some civil rights lawyers on the bench. Look at the difference in the Supreme Court when a case involving discrimination against women comes up between the approach that Justice Ginsburg takes and the approach that judges who don't have her background take. Let's put some people on the bench who fought for civil rights, who understand the importance of respecting the Constitution, and who'll make judicial decisions that are fair, objective. I'm not asking for biased judges. I'm just asking for judges who understand the reality of our society and are prepared to make the Constitution stick in that society.
I'm chuckling to myself, remembering the first line of an article that Michael Ratner wrote in a book that I co-edited. We asked him to write an article about what he would do if he was the Attorney General. And Michael said, it'd be a cold day in hell if somebody with my politics was ever appointed Attorney General. And I'm chuckling, thinking, Michael, probably the same thing about any president asking Michael Avery for advice.
Well, we can hope.
But we hope.
Why shouldn't we have judges who used to be civil rights lawyers? We've got plenty of judges who used to be prosecutors. Let's put some public defenders and civil rights lawyers on the bench and then see what kind of decisions we get.
Absolutely.
We agree. Michael Avery, it's been a pleasure as usual to have you on, and we hope to talk again in the near future.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thank you, Michael. You take it easy. The policing strategy called Broken Windows was first established in New York City under Police Commissioner William Bratton. It's a doctrine that has vastly broadened police power the world over to deadly effect. The underlying concept of broken windows policing is deceptively simple. To stop major crimes from occurring, police must first prevent small signs of disorder from proliferating, such as graffiti, litter, panhandling, the sale of untaxed cigarettes, and so forth. Disorder in the form of minor violations is presumed to breed larger disorder. Broken windows policing has functioned as an urban strategy enabling the gentrification of cities, a class project that has displaced the urban multiracial working class worldwide. It has led to widespread invasive police practices, racial profiling, police brutality, and many deaths. We now have in America a crisis of authority and legitimacy for U.S. policing. Here to speak with us is Professor Christina Heatherton, co-editor with Jordan T. Camp of the recently published book, Policing the Planet. Heatherton is an American Studies scholar and an historian of anti-racist social movements. She teaches at Trinity College in Connecticut. Professor Heatherton, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
We love the title of your new book, Policing the Planet, and we're curious why you chose that title.
Sure. Well, policing the planet really refers to the global transmission of two things. For the most part, the book is about broken windows policing, a specific policy around policing that we believe has had global impact. And more generally, we wanted to talk about a certain mentality around policing, the idea that policing could be a catch-all solution to social problems, the idea that policing could be used to clear space for new capital investments. We believe both the policy and this mentality around policing has gone global. We also believe that the struggle against it has been and necessarily has to be global. So that's why we chose Policing the Planet.
And you say that currently, as a consequence of what's going on, there's a crisis. Could you elaborate on that?
Absolutely. You know, a crisis, generally speaking, is when a social order can't be reproduced under the currently existing terms. And, you know, we think at this moment we're in a policing crisis. Just to be clear, you know, the form of policing that currently exists has always been in crisis. It's never functioned properly, especially for communities of color in this country. Policing has always been a tool to repress labor, to enforce a racist order. It's always served as a tool of capital. What's different now is that policing is facing a legitimacy crisis. The kind of old scripts that used to justify different forms of brutal policing, everything from police assaults to mass incarceration, are no longer working. So, for example, the kind of scripts that would have said, you know, Michael Brown was a thug, officers felt, you know, in danger of their lives, or even Trayvon Martin represented a certain kind of racialized threat. What we're seeing now is that those racist scripts no longer work. You have the emergence of movements like Black Lives Matter precisely because those scripts have lost their legitimacy. And we think this is a very rich moment for organizing against it.
So talk to us about broken windows policy. What's the strategy of broken windows?
Sure. You know, briefly speaking, broken windows changes police policy from response to crimes to preemption, the idea that you could stop major crimes. And so broken windows names the practice of aggressively addressing petty crimes in order to stop large-scale disorder, large-scale crimes. This was an idea that was famously described in a 1982 Atlantic Magazine article. You know, we can talk about this a little bit later, but the central metaphor says that if there's a broken window in a neighborhood and it remains unaddressed, it encourages other small crimes, which lead to larger and larger crimes. And this has been a very durable metaphor. But in practice, what this means is that police are supposed to be in charge of regulating disorder. And what does that mean? Well, New Yorkers are familiar with what are called quality of life violations. These are basically crimes of poverty, everything from loitering, trespassing, trying to get on the subway, you know, trying to get somebody to swipe you in on the subway, having a broken taillight, playing loud music, sagging your pants, etc. These are, of course, behaviors that poor and working class people don't uniquely engage in, but they are disproportionately targeted for. People can either be stopped, either, you know, because they're engaging in any of these small-scale petty crimes or infractions, or because there's a potential that they have a warrant out because they couldn't pay a citation or fee the first time they were stopped for one of these small crimes. And as we've seen in so many of these high-profile cases of police killings, like the murder of Philando Castile, who was stopped, like, you know, around 50 times for petty offenses, this intense form of policing makes everybody, especially Black, Latino, Native, mostly immigrant, poor and working-class communities, criminally suspect.
Would you say that broken windows policing affords police a new kind of authorization to control and then moderate such behavior?
Absolutely, absolutely. So as I said before, you know, the major transformation that broken windows policing ushered is changing police capacity from response to preemption. And it's a really strange idea that emerges in the late 70s, you know, gained some steam in the 80s and really takes off in the 90s. People in New York will remember the kind of policies implemented under Mayor Rudy Giuliani and then Police Commissioner William Bratton. And what's so extraordinary about this idea is that it gives police a different kind of capacity. You know, it shouldn't be the job of police to maintain spatial order in neighborhoods, to be the kind of prime social regulators. But broken windows, as I said, changes police capacity from response to preemption and makes them the chief arbiters of maintaining order in a community. This sounds like an objective process, but as we've seen in the implementation of broken windows policing everywhere, this is a highly subjective practice. What constitutes disorder? This has extremely racist, classist, often very homophobic and heteronormative logics to it, which we can talk about.
Christina, how do liberals legitimize broken windows policing?
Sure. This is a really important question. I think so often we get caught in this trap of thinking about, Republican issues, Democrat issues, left, right, along that political spectrum, law and order of the right, and more kind of community-minded policies of Democrats. What we emphasize in the book, especially with an interview with Naomi Murakawa, is that broken windows policies, some of the most nefarious implementations have happened under liberal mayors, and so this includes mayors like the Democrat liberal Antonio Villaraigosa in Los Angeles, Gavin Newsom when he was mayor of San Francisco, Martin O'Malley, former presidential candidate when he was mayor of Baltimore, and of course, Bill de Blasio in New York City.
We're speaking with Professor Christina Hetherington, who has co-edited a very important book that we want to recommend to all our listeners. It's called Policing the Planet. Just came out, and we were lucky enough to get an interview with her. Let's proceed, Christina. I wanted to ask you, why do you write that deaths at the hands of the police are not minor excesses or accidents, but routinized and widespread?
Sure. This is a question I get asked a lot, and the question sometimes gets phrased this way. Are people actually getting killed and assaulted more, or are we just more aware of them? And I think, a combination of people just filming police encounters, people filming these different police killings, having the technology to document, spread, and share these incidents has offered, greater awareness of them and, has subsequently enabled a broader scale organizing around these police killings. And this is part of how you see the kind of legitimacy of this form of policing, losing its hold. You cannot simply, call up the same scripts that worked in a different period to say, well, Michael Brown was a thug. Eric Garner was a thug that police legitimately feared for their lives. What you see is that you basically have the wrong tool for the problem. What we say in the book is that when your only tool is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And what we contextualize the question of broken windows policing within the political economy of the last 40 years. And so we're trying to think about when disproportionate public funds have gone into policing and prisons, when you've seen the defunding of other social services such as health, transportation, housing, education, when police have become the catch-all solution to every problem, these are the kind of fatal encounters that get produced. So it's not an accident, it's not an aberration when these killings happen. This is precisely routine and systematic. When your only tool is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. It's not an accident that so many of these police killings are happening, and an entire spectrum of police violence and violations are happening every day.
In terms of the rampant police violence that we're seeing, do you believe it can be solved with the addition of more police, better trained officers, a more diverse police force, or a better monitored police force?
Sure. And this is related to the earlier question you asked about how liberals legitimate broken windows policing. You know, we have this great fantasy that we can simply legislate police to behave better. That, you know, as you said, if we diversified police forces, if we gave them, sensitivity training, if we slightly moderated the form of fatal weapons available to them, that this would solve all of our problems. And as we showed throughout the book, this is a baseless formula, and this is, you know, a very old script. I mentioned her before, but Naomi Murakawa, who's a professor at Princeton, we do an interview with her in the book, and she describes how actually a lot of the recommendations being proposed right now, both by police chiefs, by FBI Director James Comey, and even by the President's 21st Century Task Force on Policing, recommend this whole range of policing reforms. And what she says is these are identical to the reforms proposed in the 1960s under President Johnson. And just as then, as now, they don't work. What they serve to do is open up a new stream of revenue to policing. You cannot solve the problem by simply refunding the problem as it exists. And so these new calls to implement the reforms that you mentioned, or even change the name of broken windows policing to community policing, all they do, in fact, is re-entrench and reinvest in the very form of policing that we already have that we're trying to fight with no actual enforceable protocol to change it.
We're speaking with Christina Hetherington, who co-edited the book Policing the Planet. And you write that broken windows policing has become the political expression of neoliberalism at an urban scale. Can you break that down for us? What's neoliberalism, and what do you mean by it's becoming the political expression on an urban scale?
Sure, it's a mouthful, and I'll do my best to explain it as briefly as I can. You know, we think a lot about the political economy. What was the political and economic situation within which broken windows emerged and has become dominant? What we see is broken windows emerges in a period of deindustrialization, in a period of mass unemployment, of mass underemployment, in the period, I believe, 1983, there's a law professor at UCLA who said this was the first time the term homelessness gets used to refer to a kind of state of being rather than a condition produced after a natural disaster. So you see any number of social problems emerging in this period. You have in what amounts to an actual landscape of broken windows, of abandoned factories, of abandoned homes, of a newly vulnerable population. And when you think about the emergence of this form of policing that targets small signs of visible disorder, that turns people with problems like housing problems, health problems, problems of unemployment, drug addiction problems, and turns those people with problems into problems, you have a successful way of managing a social crisis. And so we wanted to call attention to how turning people into criminal problems, taking them out of the purview of different sections of the state and making them subjects of the police, this has been a tactic of management under neoliberalism. And when you think about where and how these practices have been implemented, for example, and most famously in New York City, you have to understand that these practices were implemented at the same time as you've seen the gentrification and the redevelopment of major urban centers. And so it's not as if this is a form of policing that's just practiced in all places at all times. But very specifically, when you think about areas like Times Square in New York City, the Chelsea Piers, downtown Los Angeles, you could go, Union Square in San Francisco, and you think about where these crackdowns have happened. Not coincidentally, they have happened in places slated for major redevelopment and gentrification. You have to clear space in order to build on it. And this is the logic of broken windows policing. This is what has been globalized, and this is what we're trying to make clear in the book.
Christina, if I can summarize that last pithy comment, is it accurate to say that you see broken windows policing as a way to enable gentrification, displacement, and the stripping of assets from the poor and communities of color?
Yeah, well, that's exactly how I would have said it if I could have said it better, yes. You know, the book really comes out of a longtime engagement that my co-editor Jordan T. Camp and I had with a group called the Los Angeles Community Action Network, based in Skid Row, Los Angeles. And what we saw in Skid Row, Los Angeles was the implementation of broken windows policing under Police Chief William Bratton. This is the same Bill Bratton who was police commissioner in New York City in the 90s.
Had him twice.
Yeah, you had him twice. You had him twice, just like a curse. Briefly, he was a police chief in Los Angeles, and he implemented a form of broken windows policing there. And in Skid Row, Los Angeles, which has the densest concentration of poverty in the whole country, a disproportionately black area, this is a place where a lot of the formerly employed workers in the defense industries and the former industries in California have ended up. This is one of the homeless capitals of the country. You saw the brutal implementation of broken windows policy there called the Safer Cities Initiative, which, as Gary Blasey from the UCLA School of Law says, represented the highest concentration of police resources anywhere in the world outside of Baghdad. I mentioned this long example to say that Skid Row, Los Angeles, as I've described it, is known to many people as the new redeveloped downtown Los Angeles. This is the same area where you've seen the Staples Center be built, a series of lofts and boutique hotels and restaurants. The two things go hand in hand, and if you ask people who are fighting to exist in this place, they understand the connection between policing and gentrification. We're just trying to build off of their struggles and their insights to make this clear to people who are seeing it from the outside.
Christina, in the few minutes remaining, could you please talk about abolitionist alternatives to the policing crisis, including access to jobs, healthier food, and shelter?
Absolutely. So, you know, the book is a series of essays and interviews, as well as images and poetry from different activists and scholars, lawyers, journalists, who are addressing the issue in a number of ways. But the common thread that runs throughout the book is this question of, you know, if not this form of policing, then what? And what every entry talks about is essentially a form of abolitionist politics. And what do we mean by that? You know, when people hear the word abolition, it sounds like just a question of negation. How do you get rid of something? And what all the contributors to the book make clear is that abolition, just as it was in the time of the abolition of slavery, it wasn't just the removing of a certain institution, but it was the coincidental removal of something and the building up of something else. And so, you know, when we ask people across the country, how do you understand this crisis and what do you understand as a solution to it? People say, well, you know, maybe the only tool the state should have shouldn't be a hammer, and maybe every problem shouldn't look like a nail. Maybe we have to think about people with problems like housing problems, like unemployment problems, like drug addiction problems as social problems. Maybe we need to, not invest all our public money into a failed strategy of policing all those problems, and maybe we have to think about a building up of a different kind of social infrastructure. If I could just say briefly what this means in practice, in places like downtown Los Angeles that I mentioned, the budget for homelessness is $100 million. $87 million of that goes to policing. Now, if you could imagine that money actually went to things that people actually need, to housing, to jobs, to services, we'd be talking about a totally different landscape. We're trying to think about that, you know, in cities across the country, in cities around the world, we're trying to think about undoing that mentality that police can be the catch-all solution to all our problems.
Christina, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to wind up by asking you this. What's your vision of a different future emerging out of the present? For example, what did you think of the Movement for Black Lives platform?
I'm so glad you asked that. And I mean, this is, the book, is an attempt to amplify the voices of people that we are, that we think are envisioning a future in the present. So the Movement for Black Lives platform, I encourage everybody to read it. There are also other documents that we refer to in the book. There's a group out of Albuquerque, New Mexico called the Red Nation. They have a 10-point platform that's very similar. There are documents such as the People's Budget that comes out of Los Angeles with groups like the Youth Justice Coalition. This is related to the long history of freedom charters, like the ones organized out of South Africa, you know, where people are imagining and trying to implement changes in the present that could enable us to envision a new future. It's not up to me as an egghead professor to say this is where I think, you know, we should go. It's up to all of us to learn to listen to social movements that are on the ground, that are trying to fight these things, that are trying to imagine a future in the present. And I think the platforms that you outline do a beautiful job of helping us imagine what that future could look like.
Thank you so much, Christina. You co-edited with Jordan Camp the just published book, Policing the Planet, Why the Policing Crisis Led to Black Lives Matter. We encourage our listeners to get a copy of Policing the Planet. It's really an intelligent book, and we're so grateful for your being on Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
National Tribunal has declared the impeachment of Brazil's president and head of the Workers' Party, Dilma Rousseff, an illegitimate coup. The Tribunal for Democracy in Brazil convened in Rio de Janeiro 2 months ago. It was organized by social movements in Brazil to analyze and render a judgment on what they described as a break in the democratic process and a new type of coup. We speak today with attorney Azadeh Shashashani, who is a member of the tribunal. She recently wrote an article on its findings for The Nation magazine. Attorney Shashashani is the legal and advocacy director with Project South and a past president of the National Lawyers Guild. Azadeh, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me.
Azadeh, you were a member of the International Tribunal who recently traveled to Rio in Brazil to investigate the impeachment of Brazil's woman president and Workers' Party member Dilma Rousseff. The tribunal concluded that she was the victim of what you called an illegitimate coup. Why do you call it that?
Well, because this is an illegitimate attempt to try to take power away from a democratically elected president. More than 54 million Brazilians voted for President Dilma Rousseff. And now, you know, the right-wing forces and the rich are basically trying to take that away and nullify the votes of, mainly Brazilian working class and others who supported Dilma. And I should also mention, there's no basis for these impeachment proceedings. So the Brazilian law and constitution specify that a president, in order to be impeached, has to have committed some serious crime. Even assuming that President Rousseff moved money between accounts, that is not a crime. And so there's no grounds for the impeachment proceedings in the first place.
What were the reasons? Was it that she moved money from one place to another to balance the budget? Was that the reason that the members of the Brazilian Chamber of Deputies gave to impeach her?
Right, right. They're saying that she moved money from the federal bank to some other accounts in order to cover up budget shortfalls in the lead up to the elections.
Well, that was the official reason, but what, in your opinion, was the real reason?
Well, I mean, as I said, they're trying to take power back. You know, they can't get elected in an election, and they haven't been able to do that in quite a while, and so they're trying to take power back in order to try to implement a neoliberal agenda favored by the U.S. And also, let's remember that many of these people who are going after President Dilma Rousseff themselves are, in fact, being, you know, facing indictments or have been accused of various acts of serious corruption. And so because President Dilma Rousseff indicated that she was not up for stalling or foregoing the corruption investigations, they felt that, you know, it's in their best interest to get rid of her and to install somebody who's in their own league. And so the vice president, the former vice president, Temer, who's now the interim president, he himself has been accused of corruption. And so, you know, if the impeachment proceedings are in fact successful, Temer will be the one who will be president until the 2018 elections.
The statistic that you cite in your recent article for The Nation magazine is that 60% of the members of the Chambers of Deputies are under indictment for corruption. 60%? Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate on that?
60%. Well, I mean, they are being tied to various, you know, acts of corruption related to, you know, Petrobras or otherwise, you know, accepting bribes. Some of them, actually, some people from the Temer interim cabinet, let's remember this is an all-white male cabinet, very different from, you know, the type of leadership that President Rousseff had in place. So some of the cabinet members, after the you know, that allegations came to fore, actually stepped down. And there were also series of leaked wiretaps showing that there was basically a conspiracy between some of the right-wing officials to try to stall the corruption investigations.
There's a misogynistic element here on the attacks on President Rousseff. Could you talk to us about that?
So, you know, we heard from four witnesses for each side, and one of our witnesses, a very well-known professor who is a feminist, talked to us about the attacks that President Rousseff is facing as a woman, and, you know, the kind of really crude sexist jokes that are directed at her. Let's remember President Rousseff was a leftist guerrilla, you know, back in the 1970s during the reign of the military dictatorship supported by the U.S. And so she was captured at some point by the right-wing forces, and she was tortured and she was raped in custody. And so the professor who testified to the jury, she reminded us that you know, some of the lawmakers had actually made fun of this fact that she had been raped, and there are all sorts of really sexist, you know, imagery targeting President Rousseff that is being circulated in Brazil.
So the impeachment is in process, but it isn't yet in place. I mean, they've got to get the Senate now to vote on it. But if indeed it is successful and she is impeached, what effect will this have on Brazil's working classes?
The Senate is voting on this today as we speak. It's Wednesday, August 31st. So the Senate is voting. They have been, you know, debating this for a couple of days now, and President Rousseff actually spoke to the Senate and defended herself and testified to the fact that she's innocent of any acts of corruption or other types of crimes, and it is those going after her who are in fact, you know, alleged to have committed crimes against the Brazilian people. You know, unfortunately, it looks like the right-wing forces have enough votes to, you know, go forward with the impeachment. You know, if that is successful, she still does have the right to appeal to the Supreme Court, even though very unlikely that they will take action. And so the impact of that on the working class will be severe. You know, I think we can make comparisons to Argentina with, you know, of course, with the difference that, you know, the right-wing president there was actually elected, but sort of, you know, some of the policies that he's putting into effect. I read recently that he's actually, in fact, starting to deny this, you know, the number of dissidents in Argentina who were killed. And so, you know, Temer and co. have already put into place some policies cutting back on social programs. So let's remember President Dilma Rousseff and Lula before her played a significant role in lifting people out of poverty through the various types of social programs that they instituted. And so, you know, Temer and his team have an agenda that is, you know, very much neoliberal, following, you know, U.S. policies. And so there will be cuts to these various social programs. And so, you know, the impact will, in fact, be severe.
We've been speaking with attorney Asadeh Shashashani about the coup that's unfolding in Brazil following a change of government in Argentina and Honduras. It looks like the leftist governments that have come to power in Central and Latin America are on the wane now, and particularly with the largest country in Latin America, Brazil, now looking like it's going to fall to the neoliberal axe. And you've been very helpful, Asadeh, in explaining this to us, and we're grateful for you being on Law and Disorder. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Thank you.